another narrative has got out there. That is the claim, a claim that ignores all the actual evidence, that insists that our whole history is a pro-Western whitewash, and that it is therefore the job of anyone committed to justice to overturn this narrative. And so, just as the realities of race in the modern West are put through this distorting projection, so the reality of how our history is taught today and what our history was actually like are put through an identical distorting effect. The effort to do this is now going on at the highest imaginable levels. Reframing our history. There have been many efforts to rewrite the history of the West in recent years, but few have been as high profile or as pronounced in their intent as a project launched by the New York Times in August 2019. The 1619 Project could have been launched by any number of institutions, such as a university. But for it to be launched by a newspaper, and one which is still sometimes referred to as a paper of record, is highly unusual. For the project was not a piece of reportage. It was an attempt to reframe and rewrite the founding story of America. That wasn't what critics said about it. It is what the project's founders said about their own project. The project was launched with a 100-page special edition of the Sunday magazine. In her introductory piece, for which she subsequently won a Pulitzer Prize, Nicole Hannah-Jones made the bold claim that the date of the arrival of the first slaves on the continent should be regarded as the true founding date of America. The introductory paragraph read, "The 1619 Project is a major initiative from the New York Times observing the 400th anniversary of the beginning of American slavery. It aims to reframe the country's history, understanding 1619 as our true founding, and placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of black Americans at the very center of our national narrative." Hannah Jones, who is a reporter, not a historian, repeatedly made this claim about 1619 being our true founding. In January 2020, she told an audience at Ann Arbor that our true founding is 1619, not 1776. And, in a conversation with Jake Silverstein, editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine, 2 months after the project's launch, Silverstein said, "We sort of proposed the idea in a variety of ways that if you consider 1619 as the foundational date of the country, rather than 1776, it just changes your understanding, and we call that a reframing of American history, like you're moving the whole picture over to a new center point." As might be expected, this claim caused a certain amount of pushback, and, in response, a number of strange things happened. Within a year of the project's launch, Hannah Jones herself claimed that she had never said what she had been saying since the launch. "The 1619 Project does not argue that 1619 is our true founding," she claimed. Though it might be noted that her Twitter banner still had a picture of 1776 with that date crossed out and replaced by 1619. Still, she insisted that the only people who had made this claim about her project's aims were the right. Yet there it was. Or there it had been. For, as the controversy grew, the New York Times silently edited the web pages in question, so that this especially inflammatory claim no longer appeared on them. The words understanding 1619 as our true founding, were quietly removed. And, after they had done this little bit of erasing, the paper's editors then went about pretending that they had never said the words that they had in fact said, or that when they had used the words, they had used them in a way that had a different meaning than the usual meaning such words had. Jake Silverstein, for instance, wrote that what the project was trying to explain was a rather complex idea, and that when they had said that 1619 was the true founding date of America, they had in fact intended it as a metaphor. In a generous act of self-backpatting, he noted that some critics had said that this metaphor of his offered a clearer vision of American history than had previously been available. Silverstein then did a little rejigging of his own. In his introductory essay, published in August 2019, he had written, 1619. It is not a year that most Americans know as a notable date in our country's history. Those who do are at most a tiny fraction of those who can tell you that 1776 is the year of our nation's birth. What if, however, we were to tell you that this fact, which is taught in our schools and unanimously celebrated every 4th of July, is wrong, and that the country's true birth date, the moment that its defining contradictions first came into the world, was in late August of 1619. Soon, the online version of this, too, was silently edited. Specifically, the words, "This fact, which is taught in our schools and unanimously celebrated every 4th of July, is wrong, and that the country's true birth date," were deleted. Perhaps Silverstein wondered for a moment whether to pretend that the words "is wrong" was also a rather brilliant metaphor, also praised by many critics. Instead, he fell back on something else, which was claiming that the changes to the text were so minor as to be immaterial. In fact, it is hard to think of anything that could be more material than the question of when a country, specifically the most powerful country on earth, was founded. The editors at the New York Times ought to have expected that every inch of ground involving the 1619 project would be fought over, because the project was more than a reframing or a rewriting. The project was a deliberate transposing of American history into a minor key. The move of the founding date was not just about proving that everything that made America exceptional, including its economic power, its industrial power, and its system of democracy, had come out of slavery. It was intended to formalize the idea that the USA was founded on an original sin. It sought to turn a tale of heroism and glory into one of oppression and shame. Perhaps the authors of this project did not expect to get so much attention, or failed to imagine that they would dominate the nation's discourse at such extraordinary speed. But that is what they did. Within living memory, the story of America had been one of a great leap into glorious liberty, led by some of the most remarkable men of their or any age. Now, instead, the American story was rooted in a crime that could apparently never be alleviated. If the authors thought they would get away with this unopposed, then they were wrong. But, given the audacity of their efforts, they might have tried to be a little more careful with their claims. Because the work in question was so shoddy that it did not even try to hide its exclusively political aims. A historical study of the many difficult aspects of American history can be easily recognized. That would seek to take complex junctures in the round, It would survey individuals not through the prism of a single phrase or action, but through an understanding of what they did throughout their lives. It would look at the circumstances of the time, what other countries and cultures were doing at the same moment, and much, much more. Hannah Jones and her colleagues clearly had no desire to do this, and would have been unqualified for the role even if they had aspired to it. For instance, in her introductory essay, Hannah Jones made the claim that one of the primary reasons that the colonists wanted independence from Britain was that they wanted to protect the institution of slavery. She cites two pieces of evidence from 1772 and 1775 to justify this claim. The first of these was the British legal case Somerset versus Stuart. But it is quite bizarre to pretend that a British legal case that had no reach in America was one of the major reasons for America's independence. Even stranger was to do so while presuming that the reasons for independence, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, were unimportant. Until now, the reasons for independence given in the Declaration of Independence had been thought to be suggestive, at the very least. For the 1619 project, they were not. And so its crack team set out to ignore the historical record and scour the land for anything that could accord with their own preordained theory. Even worse among the opening essays in the newspaper's project was a piece of work by a sociologist called Matthew Desmond. Perhaps it was inevitable that a sociologist trying to write history would make as many historical mistakes as Desmond did. But what was even more inevitable was that he should have used his contribution to attack capitalism. As the headline read, "In order to understand the brutality of American capitalism, you have to start on the plantation." The ensuing work attempted, ineptly, to smear capitalism as a whole by claiming that its sources lay in slavery. For example, at one point, Desmond attempted to draw a clear line of association between modern corporations and slave plantations. This is how he did it. "Everything in modern corporations," Desmond wrote, "is tracked, recorded, and analyzed via vertical reporting systems, double-entry record-keeping, and precise quantification." According to Desmond, "many of these techniques that we now take for granted were developed by and for large plantations." To put it politely, this is a wildly ignorant argument. Desmond offers no evidence that the plantations were the places where these techniques originated, and that is because there is no such evidence. If the New York Times hired anti-capitalist had a wider historical purview and a less dogmatic anti-capitalist standpoint, he might have noticed something else, which is that many successful enterprises across history share the attributes he describes. After all, could there be a reason why a system in which things are tracked, recorded, and analyzed might work better than a system in which things are, for instance, lost, ignored, and forgotten about? By now, Desmond had the wind in his sails. His anti-capitalist critique continued. "When a mid-level manager spends an afternoon filling in rows and columns on an Excel spreadsheet, they are repeating business procedures whose roots twist back to slave labor camps." Indeed, such a line would have to be very long and very twisty. For the mid-level manager could also be said to be doing something that careful bookkeepers have done throughout history, as far back as Pharaonic Egypt and the Mesopotamian Sumerians, neither white. Occasionally, The 1619 author tries to summon up someone who will support his assertions. Just about the only person he can locate is one Caitlin Rosenthal, the author of a 2018 book about slavery. Desmond cites her in his defense, but fails to note that his own source says, "I did not find a simple path where slaveholders' paper spreadsheets evolved into Microsoft Excel." In other words, Desmond cites a source that says the opposite of what he says to justify his case. Elsewhere, he misunderstands his sources, misquotes statistics, and fails to note a somewhat central fact. The plantation system was not a capitalist system. It was a feudal one. But people who hate the West always hate Western capitalism, and are willing to praise or turn a blind eye to the failings of any other economic system so long as they can portray free market capitalism as simply another arm of Western colonialism and oppression. It appears that Desmond's assignment was simple. It was to smear the capitalist system. Hannah Jones and the New York Times wished to portray everything in American life as having been born in the original sin of slavery. And Matthew Desmond was simply hired to do the hit job on capitalism. But everything else in the project was equally assertive and equally ill-informed. According to Hannah Jones, America was not even a democracy until black Americans made it one, which is the sort of assertion you might make at a rally, but not one normally associated with a historical project, even a historically revisionist project published by a newspaper. Understandably, this all eventually became too much for some actual historians in the relevant fields. A number of leading scholars of American history, Sean Wilentz, James McPherson, Gordon Wood, Victoria Bynum, and James Oakes, wrote to the New York Times to object to the project. While applauding all efforts to look into history, they complained that, on matters of verifiable fact that cannot be described as interpretation or framing, the project had got its history severely wrong. The historians said that the 1619 project reflected a displacement of historical understanding by ideology. From all political sides and none, the corrections to the 1619 project began to pour in. In an interview with a socialist website, James Oakes of the City University of New York made an interesting complaint about the project from the political left. He complained that the worst thing about the project's propagandizing was that it leads to political paralysis. It's always been there. There's nothing we can do to get out of it. If it's in the DNA, there's nothing you can do. What do you do? Alter your DNA? As well as moral objections, errors and dishonest summaries in the 1619 project kept being identified. But still, the New York Times stuck by its project. Too much had been invested in it. The paper of record had decided that it was going to change the record, whether the historians agreed or not, and whether the facts supported them or not. This was neither journalism nor history, but a political campaign. Unable to answer any of the criticisms of her project's basic historical flaws, Hannah Jones retreated into two moves. One was to lash out. On Twitter, she derided white historians and LOL'd at the idea that they produce truly objective history. When someone described McPherson as a preeminent historian of the Civil War, she replied, "Who considers him preeminent? I don't." After this, she went for the wounded maneuver. She complained that she had not been contacted by any of the scholars privately, and insisted that if she had been, she would have taken their concerns very seriously. Instead, she said, there had been kind of a campaign of getting people to sign on to a letter that was attempting really to discredit the entire project without having had a conversation. By this logic, of course, it might be said that all Americans should feel wounded, because Nicole Hannah-Jones had rewritten their country's birth date and was trying to rewrite the nation's entire history, and had done so without really contacting anyone beforehand, let alone anyone who knew what they were talking about. But the most interesting thing that happened with the 1619 Project was what happened when it moved from the page onto the street. In June 2020, when protests and riots followed the killing of George Floyd, the New York Post ran an opinion piece saying, "America is burning." It described how rioters had already set fire to police stations and restaurants, had looted shops across the country, and were now coming for statues, including George Washington's, which had just been torn down in Oregon. "Call them the 1619 riots," the author wrote. Hannah-Jones noticed this and took to social media to accept the compliment. "Call them the 1619 riots? It would be an honour," she said, as the country was burning. "Thank you." The 1619 Riots. Just as it is striking how swiftly obscure ideas can spill out from academia, so it is striking how swiftly ideas pumped out in the media can make their way onto the streets. Around the time that the 1619 Project came along, America was clearly ripe for a reframing by those opposed to nearly every aspect of its founding. In 2020, a survey showed that by that year, 70% of self-identified liberals wanted to rewrite the US Constitution into one that better reflects our diversity as a people. Basic tenets of American history that right and left had agreed on until now, and which had, for generations, united Americans of every background, were suddenly subjects of fundamental disagreement. Nowhere was this clearer or more visceral than in the spate of statue toppling that burst out from the summer of 2020 onward. For, in no time, that movement shifted its attention from contested figures in American history to every single major figure at the heart of the American experiment, from the founders onward. It started at the contested margins with the Confederates. In the days that followed the death of George Floyd, the city of Birmingham, Alabama, removed a Confederate monument erected 115 years earlier. In Alexandria, Virginia, the authorities removed the Appomattox statue, erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1889. Across the country, similar actions were taken. The University of Alabama announced that it would remove several plaques dedicated to Confederate soldiers who had attended the school. And in Jacksonville, Florida, after a Confederate statue commemorating the Jacksonville Light Infantry was vandalized, a crew of cranes moved in during the early hours of the morning and took the statue apart. There were not many objections to all of this. Few people wished to defend the maintenance of Confederate statues, and even fewer wished to do so in the immediate aftermath of a horrible, apparently racist killing. But the authorities and crowds that started on the Confederate statues soon found it very hard to know where their iconoclasm should stop. The statues of Christopher Columbus were a major focus of their ire. though this was hardly the first time that the explorer had been in the sightline of anti-Western activists. During the 1990s and 2000s, there had been eruptions of anti-Columbus sentiment in America. But all of this picked up in 2020, with statues of Columbus being assaulted and pulled down across the country. During the great iconoclastic rage of that year, statues of Columbus were either torn down by crowds or preemptively removed by the authorities in Chicago, Pittsburgh, Boston, Minnesota, Virginia, and dozens of other places across America. As the days went on and the crowds searched for more and more stone victims, they got ever nearer to the holy spots of American history. Within under a month after George Floyd's death, a crowd in northeast Portland pulled down a statue of George Washington and graffitied it with the words, "You're on native land," and "Genocidal colonist." They also marked it with the letters BLM plus the date 1619. On that occasion, the crowd also set fire to the statue's head, draped it in an American flag, and then set that on fire too. During the same period, a crowd pulled down a statue of Thomas Jefferson outside a high school named after him, spray-painted him with the words "slave owner," and also wrote the name of George Floyd over him. Soon, it was George Washington's turn again, with a statue of him being covered in red paint and then torn down in the downtown area of Los Angeles. In San Francisco, it was Ulysses S. Grant who was targeted, with a crowd assaulting the monument to the president who led the Union armies in defeating the Confederacy. And it was by this stage that it looked as though all American history was in the crosshairs. The statue of Spanish missionary Father Junipero Serra was soon torn down in Los Angeles, as was that of Francis Scott Key, the lyricist of The Star-Spangled Banner. So comprehensive was the destruction in some cities that the authorities were frantically removing statues to try to get ahead of the crowds. After assaults on statues of Abraham Lincoln in other parts of the country, the authorities in Boston announced that they would take apart and remove their statue of Abraham Lincoln and a freed slave, which stood in Park Square. While at Hofstra University in New York, the university authorities moved a statue of Thomas Jefferson on the campus in response to a "Jefferson has got to go" movement. In 2018, the university authorities had rejected student calls for Jefferson to be removed, but a little over a month after George Floyd's death, the authorities removed it of their own volition. One of the students behind the campaign to remove Jefferson said that the removal and relocation of the statue was not enough, but that at least it would stop her parents having to spend sleepless nights worrying that their eldest daughter would be lynched by white supremacist groups validated by Hofstra's decision not to remove the sculpture. It seemed in that moment as though American history in the round was being erased. Statues of Confederates were coming down, but so were those of Union leaders. People who had owned slaves were coming down, as were those who had never owned a slave. Statues of those who were in favor of slavery were coming down, but so were those of people such as George Washington, who came to oppose slavery and freed his slaves. And it wasn't just the founders, but almost everybody who came after them, who was being treated in this way. At Princeton, the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs announced that it was dropping Woodrow Wilson from its name. Until then, Wilson had been best known for his peace plan for Europe at the end of World War I and for being the instigator behind setting up the League of Nations. But now, like everybody else, he stood accused of racist thinking. And so the university where he had studied and been president before reaching a higher office decided it had no further use for his name. The death of George Floyd was offered as the explanation for speeding up a consultative exercise that had been going on for some years. A new way of thinking about and looking at America had washed through the country. So much so that the then president decided to give a speech from Mount Rushmore trying to re-establish the American narrative, and doubtless hold it close to himself ahead of an election. But in some ways, what was most striking about President Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore on Independence Day weekend 2020 was not anything he said himself as he rattled through the accomplishments of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt on the rock face behind him. What was most striking was what CNN's correspondent said as the network went live to Mount Rushmore ahead of the speech. Here is how Leila Santiago described the upcoming events. Kicking off the Independence Day weekend, President Trump will be at Mount Rushmore, where he'll be standing in front of a monument of two slave owners and on land wrestled away from Native Americans. She went on to report that the president was expected to focus on efforts to tear down our country's history. Santiago appeared not to realize that her own words were at least as suggestive as anything President Trump had to say. For even a couple of years earlier, it would have been inconceivable for an anchor at one of the main networks to use language entirely lifted from the most radical revisionist figures in America. If Mount Rushmore is stolen, then what is the rest of the country? Before the modern era, the whole history of our species was one of occupation and conquering. One group of original peoples were replaced by another group of other peoples. And someone outside the American continent was always going to discover America. What exactly were Columbus and subsequent Europeans meant to do after making their discovery? Should they have returned home and said that there was nothing to see? Should they have kept their discovery to themselves, waited for someone else to find it, or declared America a place with no potential? The ineluctable conclusion of this narrative is that it would have been better if Columbus had never discovered America, or that it would have been better if it had been found and settled by some other more suitable civilization, such as the Chinese or Japanese. But these notions are not just ahistorical. At this stage, they are also completely self-destructive. For if the land you are on is simply stolen, the founding fathers were simply slave owners, then what exactly holds this grand quarter-millennial-long project together? None of this is new. In a period of such rich iconoclasm, it is easy to think that the present anti-Western moment came from nowhere. In fact, it has been bubbling up for decades, specifically since the post-colonial period, when the European powers were in retreat and America was struggling with the problem of how to be a superpower without acquiring an empire. Throughout this period, perhaps it was inevitable that a certain anti-Western attitude would advance. The post-colonial period got off to a variety of starts. In some places, the withdrawal was smooth. In others, it opened up vacuums that consumed everything in the vicinity. But wherever the case, as the West retreated, anti-Westernism advanced. A correction was due. But in no time, that correction became an overcorrection. People in the former colonies who praised or emulated aspects of the colonial era were suddenly pariahs. And in the West itself, the pendulum also swung. Where once many people had thought that the West could do nothing wrong, the West entered an era where it became dangerous to concede that the West had ever done anything right. To the surprise of no one, this was whipped along and otherwise encouraged by intellectuals, specifically by those who, though unwilling to lose a drop of blood themselves, seemed keen on considerable bloodletting among other people. One such figure was Jean-Paul Sartre, who in early 1963 wrote the preface to a posthumous work by the Martinique-born anti-colonialist Frantz Fanon. From his first page, Sartre mocked the Western powers for their efforts to create a native elite in the countries they had once ruled. Sartre claimed that the West had imbued these people with the principles of Western culture, including grand, glutinous words that stuck to the teeth, leading natives to be sent home whitewashed. Such people had become walking lies, wrote Sartre. For Sartre, Fanon, by contrast, offered another way. Revolutionary socialism, altogether, everywhere. And so Sartre correctly stated that Fanon puts his readers on guard against Western culture. And all this was admirable in Sartre's eyes. For Sartre was a man who claimed to believe that the only true culture is that of the revolution. Sartre talks about people who are rather too westernized and absorbed the witchery of Western culture. And he seems almost panting at the prospect of conflict to come. In the past we made history, he writes, and now it is being made of us. The ratio of forces has been inverted. Decolonization has begun. All that our hired soldiers can do is to delay its completion. The man who Sartre raised the curtain for was equally vengeful. Fanon, who was a huge figure in his day and remains much quoted by anti-colonialist authors, said that when the native hears about Western culture, he pulls out his knife and laughs in mockery when Western values are mentioned. He wrote that in the period of decolonization, the colonized masses mock at these very values, insult them, and vomit them up. Reading Fanon now, one is struck by how much the claims that he made in the 1960s have been built upon in the decades since. For instance, Fanon wrote that the wealth of the imperial countries is our wealth too. Europe is literally the creation of the Third World. According to Fanon, the docks of Bordeaux and Liverpool owe their renown only to their traffic in slaves, and so, when we hear the head of a European state declare with his hand on his heart that he must come to the aid of the poor underdeveloped peoples, we do not tremble with gratitude. Quite the contrary, we say to ourselves, it's just a reparation which will be paid to us. For the people of underdeveloped countries, all such payments are their due. The capitalist powers must pay. Likewise, in arguments that would soon become familiar, Fanon condemned the entire Western bourgeoisie as fundamentally racist. Yet he also feared the potency of the ideas that the West exports. Because of the import of Western films, literature, and more, he was worried that the young Africans are at the mercy of the various assaults made upon them by the very nature of Western culture. Fanon didn't know how to deal with this, other than to tell people not to imitate Europe, but to create the whole man who Europe has been incapable of bringing to triumphant birth. In his rousing conclusion, he claims, 2 centuries ago, a former European colony decided to catch up with Europe. It succeeded so well that the United States of America became a monster in which the taints, the sickness, and the inhumanity of Europe have grown to appalling dimensions. There are several interesting things about this, not least that Fanon, like many other post-colonial writers who became famous in the West, is not really interested in restoring the cultures of the non-Western countries he claims to care about. He is not interested in returning African nations to an era of tribal customs or any other pre-colonial indigenous tradition. What he is interested in is analysing these cultures through a Marxist lens, and then saving them by applying a Marxist ideology to them. Naturally, there is something perverse about this. For Marx was a Western thinker with next to no knowledge, let alone experience, of non-Western cultures or societies. Just one of the ironies of the post-colonialist thinkers is that so many take the same path as Fanon. Intent on shrugging off the legacy of Western colonialism, they find an answer for every non-Western society in Western Marxism. Other arguments in Fanon have also become familiar through the West in the decades following. There is, for instance, the argument that the West is especially rapacious, and that, in this regard, it is wholly unlike all other cultures. There is the argument that the West is wholly without virtue, even while it is strangely, indeed dangerously, alluring. And then there is the insistence that revenge is called for, and that the West needs to pay for what it has done. Finally, there is the curious fact that the rage against the imperial powers of the 19th century does not stop at the 19th century imperial powers, but extends to a country that never had an empire, America. An interesting truth can be discerned here. There may be many reasons to criticize the European powers for their empires, but if this is seen as a founding sin, and Western countries that did not have empires are lumped in with those that did, then it would seem that it is not, in fact, empire that is the problem in the eyes of such critics, but the West itself. The strength and style of Fanon's writing has kept it being read, though its appeal seems mostly to lie in its lust for violence, specifically vengeance, against the West. But there is another thinker after Fanon, whose central idea reached even wider and whose interest in the Middle East ended up with him writing a crucially hostile reframing of the West. That writer is Edward Said, a Christian Palestinian born in 1935, who had an unprecedented impact on the way in which significant portions of the West thought about themselves. Like other post-colonial writers, Said's central claim is singularly anti-Western. He is uninterested in crimes committed by non-Western powers, and that disinterest helps lead him to believe that every aspect of the West even or especially its intellectual and cultural curiosity, is to be not just condemned, but derided. His central work explaining this trend, Orientalism, published in 1978, has become one of the most widely cited books across disciplines in academia. Said's central critique is an attempt to prove that when Westerners encountered other societies, they did so through the lens of the societies they came from. Despite the intelligence and style that Said could bring to his writing and his public debates, this central point is wholly unremarkable. After all, through what other lens might Western travellers and scholars have been expected to look at the Orient? Could they have been expected to look at the Middle East through Chinese eyes? Or Middle Eastern eyes? And why should Western explorers, linguists, and others be held to such a strange standard? It would be curious indeed to expect Arabs to have looked at Europe through European eyes, or for the Chinese to look at the Middle East through Aboriginal eyes. Everybody approaches a different culture through references they have picked up in the culture they are from. There is nothing sinister about this. It is inevitable. Yet, for Said, so long as the people doing the looking are Western and the cultures being looked at are not, it is very sinister indeed. Everything about the West, even the learning of its scholars, is held against it. For instance, Said wishes to blame Westerners for their allegedly narrow worldview. He ignores the fact that the Orientalists who he spurns were remarkable men and women, people who learned the languages and dialects of faraway societies and who studied these cultures almost always because they were fascinated by and admired them. Indeed, a significant strain in Orientalism always came from Westerners who admired non-Western culture more than the culture they were from, often as an escape from their own culture. In 19th century Germany, there existed a significant strain of thought that looked to the Orient as a place to give balm to the soul. Yet Said dismisses all of this, and instead levels sinister accusations against the West for all its interactions with the East. He constantly laments the Western tendency to essentialize the East, that is, to not draw precise enough delineations between one group and another, a tendency to lump a disparate group of people under one umbrella. Again, there is nothing so terrible about this. All descriptions must, by necessity, include some generalization. Not every sentence can be the length of a dissertation. Concepts that sum up large swaths of peoples, including the West, are useful, even if they cannot sum up everything contained therein. But an interesting aspect of Said's judgment in this is that while he loathes essentializing in others, he indulges in it frequently himself. For instance, at one point in his most famous work, he says, "It is therefore correct that every European, in what he could say about the Orient, was consequently a racist, an imperialist, and almost totally ethnocentric." Every European? Every single one? Where is the evidence to support that fact? If you replaced the word European in that sentence with African, Arab, or even Palestinian Christian, what might you be called? Elsewhere, Said refers in passing perfectly blithely to an average 19th century European. What is that, you wonder? It essentializes an awfully large array of people. But there was always in Said a tendency to single out Western man and woman for a unique form of attack. This included extraordinarily hostile and ungenerous attacks on two of the great female writers of the 19th century, George Eliot and Jane Austen. Said's attack on Jane Austen in one of his later books is a classic of anti-Westernism. For there, Said tries to smear Austen as a supporter of the slave trade. He does so through a solitary reference to slavery that appears in Mansfield Park during a conversation between Edmund and Fanny. In an exchange that takes up no more than a few lines of text, Austen's heroine and her husband-to-be discuss the fact that there had been such a dead silence the night before, when Fanny's uncle, who had just returned from a plantation in Antigua, had been asked about the recently abolished slave trade. Said believes that this single reference means that Austen is praising the slave trade. He makes this argument through two means. The first is that he attacks Austen by referring to later novels by other authors, including Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, saying that if we read Austen in their light, that single reference acquires a slightly greater density than that of the discreet, reticent appearances it makes in the pages of Mansfield Park. Doubtless that is so. By the same light, we might try to apply Holocaust literature to the pages of Pride and Prejudice, and marvel that this too would take on a similar density. But it would still be a strange thing to do. Stranger still is that Said should choose to use one statement by a character in a novel, a statement that incidentally suggests that the character in question is an abolitionist, to smear not just that character, but her creator, Jane Austen, as embroiled in the great sin of slavery. But through intellectual sleights of hand like this, Said provided a playbook for others who wished to criticize the West. Among his most important techniques was to interpret everything in the West, including the most delicate and perfect works of art, through a lens that was not just interrogative and hostile, but amazingly ungenerous. In doing so, he held the West to standards expected of no other society, and then castigated the West for failing to live up to these standards. He also helped to create an interpretation of the world in which the non-Western peoples were people to whom things were done, while the Western people were people who did things, and terrible things at that. Coming out of the post-colonial period, Said gave added impetus to a feeling that was already underway, a feeling that the West itself was overdue for some justice, or rather, revenge. Empire. In April 2015, there were a set of protests at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. The university had a statue on its campus of the famed 19th century imperialist Cecil Rhodes. The statue was there because Rhodes had donated the land for the university to be built on. But for some years, students and others at the university had argued that the statue was a symbol of colonial aggression and white supremacy, and so should come down. Eventually, a Rhodes Must Fall movement was formed by students and others. The university council finally voted for the statue's removal, and down it came. As ever, in the present era, what happens in one continent swiftly spreads to another. In this case, it transferred swiftly to England and the University of Oxford. One of the things that Cecil Rhodes provided for in his will was the endowment of a scholarship scheme so that students from the United States, Germany, and the then British Empire would be able to study at Oxford. He insisted on a number of stipulations for the scholarships. One of these was that no student shall be qualified or disqualified for election on account of race or religious opinions. The first black student won a Rhodes Scholarship 5 years after Rhodes's death. Since then, students from around the world, not least from South Africa, have benefited from the scheme. Nevertheless, in recent decades, there had been growing unease about the legacy of such an unabashed imperialist. In 2003, Nelson Mandela agreed to have his name appended to the scholarship scheme. That year, the Rhodes Scholarships officially became known as the Mandela Rhodes Scholarships. Asked about why he would agree to have his name linked with the great imperialist, Mandela said that South Africa's new constitution includes an injunction for us to come together across the historical divides, to build our country together with a future equally shared by all. But more than a decade after this gesture of reconciliation was agreed to, it seemed to have done nothing to placate a new generation of students. Not least, the South African students in Oxford publicly involved in the Rhodes Must Fall campaign, who appeared keen to use the international attention the issue brought to make names for themselves back home. Oriel College, Oxford, was founded in 1326, and Cecil Rhodes studied there in the 1870s. Before his death in 1902, he arranged a considerable financial bequest to the college. In addition to the scholarship scheme, his will allowed for a new building to be built for the college. It was completed in 1911 and was adorned with several statues, including one of Rhodes himself. There, high above street level, his statue stood unmolested for over a century. However, after the campaign success of Rhodes Must Fall in Cape Town, the same campaign was effectively transplanted to Oxford. The main impetus for it came at first from a number of South African students, one of whom, Tokozo Kwabe, was actually on a Rhodes scholarship at the time. Many well-meaning students from Britain and around the world joined the South African student leader, who claimed that the statue was an example of structural violence, and that this violence was not limited to a statue on a building. According to Kwabe, "The structural violence is like the curriculum, the lack of black professors. Those things are not just exceptions. They go to the very heart of how Oxford is configured and how Oxford, as a space, is, to be quite frank, racist. And this is what we are saying, that blatant violence and assault and racism is unacceptable at a university that purports to be inclusive." Soon, the claims of the anti-Rhodes campaigners grew. The Rhodes Must Fall petition in Oxford claimed that by failing to remove the statue of Rhodes, Oriel College and Oxford University as a whole continue to tacitly identify with Rhodes's values and to maintain a toxic culture of domination and oppression. The petition attracted a considerable number of signatures from across the university. Subsequent demonstrations attracted large numbers of students. To a great extent, these students, short on time, were mobilized by things that the anti-Rhodes campaign claimed that Rhodes himself had said. These quotes were immensely helpful for growing the campaign against Rhodes, for they were short, pithy, and abhorrent. The petition to the authorities at Oxford University cited several quotes from Cecil Rhodes, describing him as an apartheid colonialist. They claimed that his statements included this one: "I prefer land to N-word. The natives are like children. They are just emerging from barbarism. One should kill as many N-words as possible." These quotations were then picked up and used by other media when reporting on the petition and protests. And they are terrible quotes indeed, for they showed Rhodes to be not only a racist, but someone advocating genocide against black Africans. At such moments, with such damning material put in front of everyone, it is not easy to even query such material. But a small number of people at Oxford did, including students. They began to look at the sources of the quotes that the anti-Rhodes campaign was using, and look into their claims about Rhodes's life. What they found revealed a deep dishonesty. The anti-Rhodes petition itself offered no sources for its quotations, but the quote did turn up, ellipses and all, in a book review in the Times Literary Supplement in 2006. The author of that piece, Adekeye Adebajo, happened to be a former Rhodes scholar himself, and was quoting from a book under review by Paul Malam. That book makes it clear that the three phrases were all said at different times, but all three parts of the quote turned out to be unstable in their sourcing. These include a work from 1957 that is not a work of scholarship, and in which the author admits in the introduction that he has not given references in footnotes so as not to interrupt the continuity of the story. The first statement is said by Malam to have been made by Rhodes to Olive Schreiner at a dinner, but the only source is Schreiner herself, who used the phrase in a novel of hers in 1897 and claimed that it came from Rhodes's mouth during a speech to the Cape Parliament. It has been shown that Schreiner herself had a faulty memory on the matter, and was almost certainly referring to a speech Rhodes gave to the Cape House in 1892 on taxation and governance, in which he said, "You want to annex land rather than natives. Hitherto we have been annexing natives instead of land." The second part of the alleged quotation comes from a speech by Rhodes to the Cape Town Parliament in 1894. The full paragraph reads, "Now I say the natives are children. They are just emerging from barbarism. They have human minds, and I would like them to devote themselves wholly to the local matters that surround them and appeal to them. I would let them tax themselves and give them the funds to spend on these matters, the building of roads and bridges, the making of plantations and other such works. I propose that the House shall allow these people to tax themselves, and that the proceeds of their taxation shall be spent by them on the development of themselves and of their districts." But the third part of the quotation, "One should kill as many N-words as possible," is surely the most reprehensible quote of all. Again, the Rhodes Must Fall campaign made no attempt to reference where it came from. Again, the source would appear to be Adebajo's review of Malam, and yet this is not what Rhodes is quoted as saying in that work. There, Rhodes is alleged to have said, "You should kill as many as you can. There is no use of the N-word." That word has been inserted by the activists of Rhodes Must Fall. As for the rest of the quote, Malam cites a 1913 biography of Rhodes as his source, and if we look at this source, then the context of the quote becomes clear. The 1913 biography quotes an unidentified officer who heard Rhodes say, after an especially bloody battle with some rebels, Well, you should not spare them. You should kill all you can, as it serves a lesson to them when they talk things over at their fires at night. In other words, the statement attributed to him by Rhodes Must Fall activists, and assumed to be true by the vast majority of people who will have read it, was a wholesale misrepresentation. Indeed, it was more than a misrepresentation. It was a lie. The quotation was not a single quote from Rhodes, but a conglomeration of three alleged quotes, the first of which was from a novel, the second of which was from a speech advocating for increased African self-determination, and the third of which is an outright fabrication. Why do these details matter? Rhodes was certainly a colonialist. He was certainly a believer in the British Empire. Would a critique of this not be enough? Why would anybody need to lie and exaggerate the offence? Certainly, there are people who claim that there is an overdue reckoning or rebalancing needed for historical figures such as Rhodes. But why would they decide to base such a reckoning not on the rights or wrongs of empire or a weighing up of its human costs and benefits, but rather on an outright lie? Or rather, on a set of lies? Why would a reckoning with the legacy of empire not be enough? Why is it necessary to slip in racist epithets in order to make the past worse than it was, and to make important figures in it all come out looking like racist monsters? Among those who started to carry out his own research was Nigel Bigger, the Regius Professor of Ethics, who is also a canon at Christ Church Cathedral in Oxford. As well as being deeply unassuming and polite, he is also a famously rigorous scholar. When the Rhodes Must Fall campaign began, he started by doing what any diligent scholar might do, and read the essay on Rhodes in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. From there, he developed a growing interest, not just in Rhodes, but in the whole way in which empire was being approached. Without issuing any political pronouncements in any way, he suggested that the university could best respond to current turmoils by doing what universities are meant to be best at: scholarship. He proposed that the university should set up a project composed of historians and others dedicated to looking into the ethics of empire. Bigger suggested that this was a serious and understudied area. That much was provable. One reason why the Rhodes Must Fall campaign went so far so fast was precisely because the study of empire had become unfashionable, and so, whatever people's views on it, institutional and individual knowledge of what had happened and who had said what had been slipping away for more than a generation. If the university and the wider country was interested in working out its attitudes toward the past, then it should study the past. The rise of post-colonial studies had been a necessary correction within academia, but that period itself now needed interrogating. For, to assess the legacy of empire, it is necessary to assess the period in the round. Just as a previous period had been unable to admit to any flaws in empire, so the post-colonial period had been unable to recognise anything positive that had happened, leading to claims that were ahistorical and just plain wrong. But a second problem, Bigger identified, was that this solely negative view of empire that led to a feeling of guilt among former colonial powers had in turn led to a reluctance to deal with any of the world's present-day problems. Former colonial powers that had found themselves constantly compared with the worst regimes of the 20th century might easily find themselves denuded of the will or confidence to act even against serious rights abuses going on around the world today. The result, in other words, could be Western inertia. something over which other powers might happily seek advantage. A similar point had recently been made by another academic, Bruce Gilley, who, rather remarkably, was employed at Portland State University. In 2017, Gilley had published a paper in Third World Quarterly titled The Case for Colonialism that argued that recent attempts to turn the term colonialism into a wholly negative concept were a mistake. As he wrote, "The notion that colonialism is always and everywhere a bad thing needs to be rethought in light of the grave human toll of a century of anti-colonial regimes and policies." He argued that there was a need to accurately re-evaluate the past in order to improve the future. In both cases, Bigger and Gilley, this call for level-headedness and historical fairness did not go down well with their respective critics. In the case of Gilley, there was such a backlash to his article that 15 members of the 34-member editorial board of the journal that published it resigned in protest. Despite having gone through all the necessary peer review processes before publication, petitions and even threats of violence against the journal's editor led to the article being withdrawn and the publication apologizing for ever having published it. Gilley himself was also attacked, accused of white supremacy by fellow academics, and subjected to death threats. Bigger did not get off much more lightly. After he announced his intention to launch a program looking into the ethics of empire, a collection of more than 50 of his fellow academics at Oxford wrote a joint letter to the Times condemning his initiative. They said that it was not possible to create a balance book of positive entries to counterbalance, for example, the Amritsar massacre. They accused Bigger of ignorance, of misstating the current state of the debate, and indeed of talking nonsense. Other academics associated with the project were pressured to resign, and did so. According to the anti-Bigger scholars, no historian, or as far as we know, any cultural critic or post-colonial theorist, argues simply that imperialism was wicked, which simply suggested that the signatories had not read very far. This letter was then joined by a further letter from more than 170 scholars around the world who wrote condemning Oxford for even considering giving a berth to Bigger's proposed programme. These critics accused Bigger of being a long-time apologist for colonialism and of aiming to provide a rehabilitation of the British Empire. A student group aiming to challenge racism and colonialism claimed that Bigger's project was yet more evidence of Oxford racism. An academic at Cambridge referred to him as a gnarled old racist, and on the announcement of the course declared on social media with great academic rigour, "OMG, this is serious shit! We need to shut this down!" Elsewhere, Bigger's scholarship was dismissed as supremacist shite. He was called a racist and a bigot, and told that whatever came out of his mouth was vomit. The treatment of Bigger, like the treatment of Gilley, suggested something more than normal academic disagreement. The backlash suggested that these scholars had crossed over some unspoken threshold. And of course, they had. Just as in the early 20th century, the default consensus at a university such as Oxford would have been that the empire was a force for good, so by the early 21st century, it had become the default position at such places that the empire was solely a force for bad. The dogma, had simply shifted. So now it was not even possible to try to weigh up the moral complexities of empire without being accused of being an apologist for or supporter of colonialism. Inadvertently, these critics showed the fragility of their arguments. Because other people, not least in the countries that had been colonized, were capable of thinking with far greater nuance. For instance, the Nigerian novelist and hero of anti-colonialism, Chinua Achebe, said in 2012, "The legacy of colonialism is not a simple one, but one of great complexity, with contradictions, good things as well as bad." And in his final book, There Was a Country, 2012, Achebe wrote, "Here is a piece of heresy. The British governed their colony of Nigeria with considerable care. There was a very highly competent cadre of government officials imbued with a high level of knowledge of how to run a country. British colonies were, more or less, expertly run. One was not consumed by fear of abduction or armed robbery. One had a great deal of confidence and faith in British institutions. Now all that is changed." Achebe is not alone in his assessment. Scholars